All right, let's do this. Where do I sit? Right here?
Okay.
Is this coffee here for me?
Oh, okay, cool.
Thank you. Yeah. Cheers. Not a bad blend, actually. I like that. What? Oh, the script? Yeah, I have it right here. Yeah, I read it. Yeah. What? I'm a professional. I know what I'm doing. Y'all ready? No? Let's rock, then. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the SAFTAcast. I'm your host, Scott C., and I gotta get up, get down. Folks, we have a great show for you today, and when I say we've got a great show, I mean we have a great show for you. But before I get to telling you about today's episode, let me just update you on a few things happening with the Sundress Publications crew and the Sundress Academy for the Arts. You can think of this as the news portion of your program. Friday, April 4, that is 4-4 time on your calendar at the Jack Cellar in Knoxville, Tennessee. It is First Friday Knoxville, and the Sundress crew will be participating once again in it. Now, if you don't know what First Friday is, I suggest you get on that there internet that you enjoy so much and do a little bit of internet searching and find out what it is, because if you don't know what it is, then your community probably needs one. Trust me, it's a wonderful thing. Back to what I was saying. Friday, April 4, the Sundress crew will be presenting their program for April entitled Shakesqueer, a twisted little take on the Bard, if you will. It is a multi-format, multi-genre, multimedia experience as they will be kicking off the evening at 5 p.m., I believe it is, with a public screening of local Knoxville filmmaker Rob Simpson's version of Macbeth, a post-apocalyptic version, which should be quite interesting. Following that, Sundress will be doing what they're calling a Shakespearean drag show featuring Shakespeare's greatest hits. Now, if you want to know more about that, I suggest you jump on over onto that there social media, that book of the face, so to speak, that you enjoy so much. Find the Sundress Publications group and just like them, and you can learn a lot more information. Then, 2 days later, just two days later, Sunday, April 6th, also in Knoxville, Tennessee, but this time at the Birdhouse, the Sundress reading series continues, this time with special guests Leslie LaChance and Les Kay. I will put my special secret guarantee on this, folks. You go to one of these, you go to both of them, you're going to come away smiling. Now, folks, on to today's episode. When we put the SAFTAcast together and we hatched the idea for it, one of the first names I blurted out of guests I wanted to have on this program was Ken Robideau, the founder of Connotation Press. And it was a pleasure having him on the show. If you have never met Ken in your life, I hope you get the chance to, because he's an awesome guy. And we had much to say to each other about music. And it got me thinking, honestly, about West Virginia, which I had never really thought of, because, as I said on the program, I really only ever see it from Highway 81 passing through it on my way to New York or out of New York. So he's got me thinking that maybe next time I should just get off of some exit, whatever, on 81 and just head west and start exploring. Check out Connotation Press on the web at www.connotationpress.com for their latest issue and from stellar work from some amazing writers, twice a month, actually. But before you go and check the site out, I want you to sit back, kick back, and relax for a wee bit of talk and a wee bit of theme. That's how you do it, son. Told you I was a professional. Told you I was hardcore. Hello, Ken.
Hi.
Hey, how are you doing, man?
Good, how are you?
I'm pretty good myself. Things going well down here, I guess.
Yeah, are we gonna run on video or not?
No, I just wanted to keep it on audio.
Sounds good.
It's more of a pain. I mean, you can do it Skype or Google Plus when you're doing podcast interviews these days, but the problem with Google Plus is that it automatically creates a YouTube of your conversation. So then you have to the extra step of going through and stripping the audio out, and the same with Skype video. So it's just easier, I think.
Yeah, it sounds like a pain in the ass, either way.
It really is. I mean, it's not difficult, but it's just an extra step then, and you know, wires running through the line in and all that. Ugh, tech stuff. It's annoying. So, how are things in West Virginia right now?
Well, actually, the day wasn't bad. The last few days have been really not terribly pleasant.
No,
I think we've
I've
got
been
two
seeing the
feet of
weather
snow on our
reports.
porch.
I've been seeing the weather reports here, and when this goes to air, people will forget, but right now it's you know living hell up there in the north. This has been a rough winter, actually. It's been an odd winter, would you say?
Yeah, well, everybody keeps telling me it's worse than it usually is, but I seem to hear that every year, so I'm not sure.
Well, how many West Virginia winters have you dealt with?
A total, I was 3 years in graduate school from 2002 to five, and then I've been here for about four more for the last 4 years, so about
So,
seven, almost eight altogether.
you went to West Virginia for grad school?
WVU, yeah.
Oh, okay. The big one in West Virginia. Because I had a friend that I think worked for like I want to say it wasn't WVU. I had one that worked there, but I also had a friend I think worked for like Mechanicsburg or something college. It was a smaller one, and no, it started with an M. I have no idea. Morgantown? I have no idea. I don't know. Is there a Morgantown College in West Virginia? I don't even know.
Yeah, WVU is in Morgantown.
Okay, then maybe that's what I'm thinking. Maybe I'm just crossing my wires then.
It happens here. People send it to West Virginia. It happens a lot.
So why did you come back to West Virginia then? You left for a bit and then came back?
Yeah. Well, when I finished grad school, I went back to California. I wanted to spend the last few years with my daughters before they finished high school. And I was teaching at USC for just about 5 years. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, continue. It's you're the guest on the program, your show basically.
The employment situation got bad in California. They were laying off teachers in
Ugh.
mass.
That was,
And
and I was just about to say, isn't USC kind of a sweet gig?
yeah, well, yeah, it's a private school and they pay you disturbingly well. But
Just obscene amounts of money they're just shoveling at people. You know how it is.
yeah,
The dream academic life.
exactly. But it had just gotten really, really tough for not just me, but for a lot of people there that were teaching. And I have always loved West Virginia since I found it, since I came here for grad school. And I always planned on coming back. So
What's the appeal of West Virginia?
I think it just made that trip back sooner than I expected. That's all.
Yeah, fair enough. What's the appeal of West Virginia, to be honest? I'm curious, and I'm not dissing on West Virginia, understand.
No, first of all, I live in a little tiny place, a little private lake in the middle of the woods. Yeah, and I grew up in California, and I spent most of my life living in Long Beach. So, in Long Beach, I have 7 million neighbors, in LA County, and there's 14 million between LA and San Diego. The
Jesus.
entire state of West Virginia has about 1.6 million people. So, it's a big empty place. There's a lot of beautiful forests and a lot of beautiful places to get outside of the house and do a little hiking and camping and bushcrafting and whatever it is you like to do in the woods.
So
So
it's more
I just
tranquil then.
it's I don't have to leave 2 hours to go to the movie to find parking.
Fair enough. I've heard the horror stories of Los Angeles driving. It's just ugly. I don't know.
No, I grew up out there, and I don't have anything bad to say about it for the most part. I had just gotten tired of it. When I grew up in this little town called Corona, and we were about 35, 45 minutes to the beach on a two-lane highway each direction. That highway is now 14 lanes.
What?
At some point, you realize that you've hit critical mass. And you either leave or you figure out a way to stay. And I just got tired of trying to figure out a way to stay.
Well, from what I've heard, I've never been to Los Angeles. I'm hoping to go out there in a couple of years for the big AWP convention when they hold it out there. But everything I've heard about it is that it's the most eclectic, odd city in some regards, that you have the most amazing architecture because they don't think to remove anything. They just kind of leave it there.
You know, in some ways, I don't know, a gentleman much wiser than I once said that if you stand in Los Angeles long enough in the same place, eventually you won't be able to recognize where you are. I mean, the city changes a lot, but it changes, like you said, very eclectically. And it's a very big, very flat place. So whereas a lot of people will go to New York City and get real claustrophobic, you don't feel that same sense of claustrophobia in LA. You just feel people. Lots.
Lots of people. And lots of crushed, failed dreams. I'm sorry, go ahead.
It was 26 miles from my house to my office when I taught at USC. And it could take me an hour and a half or an hour and 45 minutes one way to get to work.
Jeez. And I thought my 15-minute commute was bad.
Just goes, yeah, no.
So eventually the body just is like, oh, the hell with this. I'm going to go where the woods are.
Yeah. Well, I spent a lot of years doing other things when I was younger and traveling and being an idiot. And I kept looking for a place that had a certain pacing, a certain rhythm. You know. And West Virginia is the closest I've ever been able to find to that in the continental United States. So.
Because, you know, my stereotypical view of West Virginia, my only experience with West Virginia is driving through it on 81, and that's only a 20-mile stretch or so on the very eastern panhandle area, because you're going through Maryland and then West Virginia, then you hit Virginia for like 7 hours on 81. So right. I don't really have that much, except that West Virginia has the single, outside of Florida, the single best tourist brochures at the rest areas. They're fascinating. It's like, here are wood-carved birds. Now here's a wood-carved, you know, whatever thing. And then, oh, yeah, here's a rock that you can buy. You know, come see rocks. It's like, this is the most eclectic, amazing thing. Now, Florida has things like, come get sponges out of the ocean. But West Virginia, there's something goofy about it, but also very sincere and homespun in it that I love.
The West Virginians are very supportive of the arts, and especially folk art.
I've noticed that.
It's all over the state. A lot of people are writers. As a publisher, West Virginia embraced, you know, what I was trying to do with the magazine, with Plantation Press. It's just a lovely place to be. Sure, there's problems. Everywhere's got problems. And there's problems here. And the problems here are very serious. And they have a lot to do with outside influences in the state. Coal companies and lumber companies. Fracking companies but it's also one of the most beautiful and one of the most art supportive states that I've ever been to. I mean, every state has something to offer, and what this particular place has to offer is what I was always kind of looking for growing up. So I'm really glad to be here. I have no interest in living anywhere else in America. I might move to Jamaica, but
in the U.S. though, no.
West Virginia.
I don't know. I could see maybe Alaska might be a choice of the United States.
I've got some friends up there. They seem to love it very much.
I'm told it's very lovely. It's one of my goals on my death list, basically, is to go to Alaska at some point and check it out. Because it's just a wild frontier of awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. For a beach kid, for a Southern California beach kid, it gets real hard for me to imagine living in winters that long. And frankly, the winters in West Virginia have gotten to be nearly 5 months long themselves. So it's getting to be, some of the winters are a little tough on me. You know, I like to be outside, and my favorite thing to do out here is to camp. I've got a ton of gear. Kate Hillenbrand, my fiance, and I camp a lot. His daughter's out here. She goes with us a lot. We just, I don't want to leave here, but I'm not sure I want to. I mean, Alaska's gorgeous, but I'm not sure I want to live that long enough.
It's like, I'll go there during the warmer months and camp up there and check out some cool stuff in the national parks. But as it starts to really get into cold areas and the summer starts to end, I'm out of there. I'm bold.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. Yeah.
So now I'm curious. Okay, you're a little kid out of, you know, you're not a little kid now, but you were a little kid in Long Beach and everything. How did you get into camping? Like, where did that come from?
I don't know.
Just something, you know.
I don't know. You know, my family did a little camping when we were kids. I don't know. It was the only time that I can remember as a kid going somewhere where I was not in crowds.
just that something about space.
So, yeah, so if you're up in the woods, there's people up there camping too, and LA, California has no place that's kind of empty.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a lot less crowded in the woods, and so I don't know, there's something about that. And you know, the natural world is astonishing.
Mm.
You know, it helps you remember a lot of the stuff that it's easy to forget when life is moving so fast.
Yeah, I mean, I live in South Florida. There are no mountains here. And I forget, because I grew up right next door to 1,200 feet of river-made shale that just creened up the mountain. I could learn how to tell forecasts. I could forecast the weather by looking at the top of the mountain. I could tell you, yep, snowstorm's coming in, and it'll be here in about 15 minutes. And, thunderstorms, I could time them. But I'm down here, and I forget until I start going north, and I hit the mountains again, and I'm like, ah, yes, now I remember how much I love thee.
Well, today, I mean, the winters aren't horrible. Today was a decent day. We had a stretch in the 30s, low 30s, and Kate and Hannah and I went out onto the lake where we live, which is now frozen, and we've got about 10 inches of ice on the lake.
Wow.
So we went out to the middle of the lake and we built a giant snow bunny, large enough to ride. And so, I don't know. I mean, there are days here in the winter where, you know, you get a little bit of blue sky and you can go out and play in it. But I don't know.
It's just
when the snow goes away, you know, I'm living in some of the most insanely beautiful forests that this country has to offer.
Outside of maybe like Colorado or something, or
I don't know. I think I'd put us up against just about anywhere.
Mm.
West Virginia is largely unpolluted by people, so you can go. There's places in this state where you can go for a hike for a few days and not see a person, maybe not even see an airplane.
Mm. That's amazing and like thrilling, but at the same time, I could see it being terrifying as well.
There are days. There are times when you're out deep in the woods where you feel a little airball when you hear something in the woods and you realize, you know, I'm way beyond being rescued out here. It's also fun, you know, especially if you're out looking for a little brook trout stream or something and you find it and you realize that maybe nobody's been out here in 50 years or more. Yeah, it's a pretty amazing feeling.
Yeah, on one hand, it's like, yeah, this is a great fishing spot and everything. On the other, it's like, I hurt my ankle walking on that rock. Oh, crap, I could break my ankle out here.
Yeah, exactly. My only chance is to start a very, very large fire that maybe someone will see from the air somewhere. But, you know, we don't even have a major airport in this state. We don't have an actual large airport in the state. The largest one is in the state capital, Charleston, and it's a very small airport. You can't fly full-size 747s into that place. And so the whole state doesn't even really have air traffic. I mean, it's really one of the few places left in the continental United States that's still very rural.
Occasionally you might hear like a prop plane go by or whatever, but that's it.
If that.
It can't be bad, though. It's not as bad nearly as Wyoming, though. Wyoming, for many years, I didn't even think Wyoming was a state. I thought it was a territory, honestly. Think about it. When was the last time you ever heard of something come out of Wyoming?
Not very often.
I can't name something outside of like the 19th century that came out of Wyoming. So I believed it was a territory. My parents went out west on vacation. I said, bring me back some proof. They asked if I wanted a souvenir. I said, bring back proof that Wyoming is a state. And they brought me back a license plate of Wyoming. And I said, okay, the federal government recognized this. They have to issue the license plate. Fine, Wyoming is a state. But I'll still dump on it whenever I get the chance.
At least when you say Wyoming, people say that's a state. When you say West Virginia, often people say, well, what part of Western Virginia do you live in?
So you live just outside of Richmond?
How did you get out of high school? You know, there's 50 of these states here.
Yeah.
Now.
No, I there's a lot of jokes about West Virginia and the inbreeding and the rednecks and all that. But I can say a lot, you know, I live in Florida. And, you know, one of the stereotypes of Florida is that we're all insane racist criminals down here.
Like I say, everywhere you go has got issues. And Florida definitely has some.
We've got a lot of
places too. Yeah, some wonderful places too. My issue with Florida always was the oranges, because I grew up in the place where the best oranges in the world were grown. And so as we watched all that die out in California and come up in Florida, it kind of like the cuss resentments. But other than that,
and like, and Minute Maid and Tropicana are standing there going, "Drink Florida orange juice."
Yeah, and Sunkissed in California is going, but
we have oranges too.
But our Valencia oranges are the best. They sell them now mostly in China, and they wrap them individually. So the oranges that are grown in Riverside County in California are now largely not even sold in America anymore.
Yeah, I mean, we get Valencias down here and everything, but they're brought in, obviously, from California. However, I won't buy them, and it's nothing against California oranges. It's just that I know I'm also at a farmer's market. I'm going to go for the local produce, which sure. should be amazing, and it usually is. Sometimes you get a bum batch or whatever, but most of the time it's amazing.
Absolutely. And besides, who wants to eat an orange that was shipped 3,000 miles?
Right. Now, if I'm in Southern Cal, I will get Valencias if they're in season because I'm you know, there's the farm right across the road. I'll get them there. So I'll do that. What about strawberries, though? Because I know Southern Cal is big on the strawberries, but Louisiana is a strong competitor.
Yeah. You know, I've never been into strawberries much, but I know up in the central part of California where, you know, California is the largest ag state in the country. Mm-hmm. So the central part of California is this humongous growing region. And I know up there it was real big. And when I was younger, a lot of Southern California was still undeveloped. It was also a lot of agriculture for a long time. And there would be big, giant fields on street corners where people would be growing and selling strawberries. And now you don't see that nearly as much because, like I said, everybody moved to California.
Yeah, California
took up all the places to grow in Southern.
When you look at the expansion of California in 50 years, it's astounding. It's like looking at pictures of Vegas in 1910 versus 1960.
Yeah, we were getting 15,000 immigrants a day into California for years and years.
Mm. And it's not and 15,000
people moving into your state.
And then you had the Hollywood and the entertainment boom just took over the state, basically.
Yeah. It's a beautiful place. It's a crazy place. There's a place full of insane possibilities. I still think there's probably no state in the country that can offer you a crazier time at any given moment.
I mean, I don't know. Louisiana is a good fight for that one, I'd have to put it. But
there's so many places that are empty in Louisiana. You go, you know, there's crazy all over California.
But where else are you going to go and you're just driving down the road and you find a hockey bar in Lafayette, Louisiana? You know, it's all about hockey. You go in, and this is from a friend of mine. I wasn't there. And the guy's like, can I get some bourbon? And you know how in France they'll open a champagne bottle with a sword? They open the bottle of Jack Daniels with a hunting knife the same way. It's like, here, we're just going to rip it open, you know?
Now, see, that sounds like a good place to me.
Have no problem there.
I'm sounding good all the way through that idea.
I had no problem as, you know, when I was a younger man or anything. I would walk into a country dive bar and just blend right in immediately. There's this little skinny suburbanite and everything, but I go into redneck. I was in Nashville a few years ago, and I walk into, we're on Printer's Row with a friend of mine, and he's a native at the time, and he's also a country music star and such. So we were wandering through, and I go in this place that's full of bikers, and I'm like, uh-oh, we might be in trouble. But as soon as they realized that we knew Waylon Jennings music and could sing it, they were all over us buying us drinks.
Nice.
It was like, yes, this is the way of living here, you know? This is how you become a good writer, so to speak. You got to live a little bit.
Well, I think, yeah, a great writer, Doug Anderson, poet, once I asked, you know, what does it take to be a really good writer? And he says, well, go get a life first. And then when you're about 30, I go, I like that.
No, I totally agree. I have disavowed any poetry I may have written between the age of 15 and 30. It's all dead. I never wrote it, you know. I will deny it to my grave. I did not write this stuff. Actually, I will deny it post. I won't deny it at my grave because we'll make a posthumous volume when I'm dead and I don't have to look at it.
There you go. So. I just think a lot of the writing that we do when we're younger is informed by the size of the world we live in.
That could be true.
And that's very small when you're young. So the older you get, the more, at least for a period of your life, you know, now as I just turned 50 this last month, and as I'm cresting the other half of my life, I'm starting to go back to making my world smaller and smaller. For a good 25, 30 years, I tried to make my world as big as I possibly could. I think
I totally understand.
That gives you more to write about, more to have a reason to, you know, to have something to say.
Not even just writing, you know, if we go beyond that, it's like the line in Fight Club that I love of, well, I don't want to die without any scars.
Yeah.
You know?
I also think that, I mean, I publish undergrads, I've published high school kids. I'm always looking for somebody's with something with a voice that shows potential. I also publish very famous people, but I'm constantly looking for never before published, young, kind of writers that are interesting to me or breaking or in some way have caught the attention of often writing teachers will send me a note saying, hey, I've got somebody you might want to check out. And so, I mean, there's great value, I think, in publishing younger folks. I also believe that yeah, a little life doesn't hurt you for something to write about. But no, I've published some really fascinating young people all the way up through undergrad. I mean, yeah, so, there's some decent writers out there that would knock me away. I when I was their age, I didn't have the patience or the discipline to write the ones people I'd seen. So
in your eyes, then, as a publisher, then it doesn't matter reputation or name. It just matters that the work is good.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing: if you publish really famous people, that will often bring people to your magazine.
Mm-hmm.
When they get there, if you provide them with a bunch of other people that are breaking and emerging and finding their voice or experimenting with a form or a genre, then you can further, you know, expand the dialogue. So from the beginning, my idea was let's run them on the same page. Let's make a front page that has, you know, a Pulitzer Prize winner or a current United States laureate, along with an undergrad. Let's see what that's like in the rest of the world, along with everything that comes kind of in between. So
it's just this nice grab bag, then, that if people go to the mag, and you guys publish twice a month, which is an impressive, impressive publication schedule for a lit mag online.
I don't know. I think it's just about killed my entire staff. Well, we've published something like 100 issues and...
How do you pull that off? I mean, because I know of so many magazines that do it maybe once a month, and that's fine. But then I know of ones that are like, yeah, our next one's going to be like in 6 months, maybe. Don't know. And I've checked your track record at Connotation. You guys have been consistent for 5 years, every 2 weeks, never missing a deadline practically.
Yeah, we've never once. We publish at midnight Pacific Standard Time on the 1st and the 15th of every month. And, we've never missed a deadline. There has been component parts occasionally because, you know, we've got 28 people on staff. Occasionally something happens and
of course,
a component part might get dropped here and there. We've never missed a deadline. And in, like I say, August will be the end of our fifth year.
Well, congrats in advance.
Yeah. Well, thank you. But look at the staff. I mean, I'm surrounded by incredibly, incredibly talented people. So, you know, it's easy for me to be congratulated, but it's my staff that knocks me out. What may happen in the future is we may slow down a little to just monthly or bi-monthly. I don't know. We'll see what happens. But yeah,
you're going to keep get this pace as long as you can.
At least through the first 5 years. Absolutely. At least through August. And then I'll make a decision with my staff and see if we want to change things up or what we want to do. It is an enormous amount to ask from a staff to publish every 2 weeks for a literary magazine. And no one, everyone on my staff works volunteer. So, you know, they don't get paid to do it.
That's a huge
thing. Anyway, it is huge. It's absolutely absurd. We published 10 poets, 10 fiction writers, 10 creative nonfiction writers, and 10 fiction and 10 poets in Hoppendoller's column, the Congress. Every month for the first 3.5 years, we just started breaking that down to like sometimes there'll be 6 in a column or whatever. But you know, imagine the numbers of people and all that vetting, all that, you know, contact. And no, it's been a wild experience.
I'm impressed. You know, I've read the site. I keep up with what's going on with it, and I enjoy what I'm seeing and everything. I love the voices and such. But I'm wondering about the work ethic. Then, like, does this speak to some kind of work ethic that you have that others may not?
I don't know what that. You know, I don't know what it is. People have asked me this a lot, and I don't know if it's just an issue of just being stupid. No, because people I very much trust told me this was a stupid idea from the beginning, and people that I really mentored me and stuff told me that we wouldn't make it a year.
Hmm.
I think it didn't occur to me. I wanted something that felt almost like the news, except in literature, something that came to you with the frequency of almost the news.
Hmm. This is what's hot right now. This is what's going on.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Or just something that was artist centered. You know, we require a photograph for all the artists that we publish and a bio, and we run the photograph and the bio before we run the work. And if we interview them, and we've interviewed hundreds of people, we interview them, that comes before the work also. Because I wanted something, I just felt like, you know, if there's a lot of people in this country that could be living next to a Pulitzer Prize winner and never know it. That's so I just thought, well, let's put pictures and bios and let's pretend the artists actually matter. Maybe I was reacting against having to take Lit Theory in grad school. But I felt like, you know, the artists, they had something valuable to give to the
work. It's not just the work that's valuable, it's the person behind the work that's valuable as well.
Exactly. Absolutely.
And that's exactly the theory of the SAFTA cast here. Is like, yeah, your work, that's fine and all, that's nice and everything, that's nice. We have a standing rule on here that if you come on and you're a writer, you can't read your work. Because we're not interested in that. If people want to read your work, they can read your work. We're more interested in, like, what are you into? Who are you? What's cool about you? And so, you know,
it's a cool idea for a podcast.
Well, we just wanted to break from the pack a little bit because I got tired of, I did a survey when we were putting this together. I did a survey of a whole bunch. I downloaded and listened to like 20 different lit podcasts, you know, samples of each one. And they all fit this standard model. You start off with royalty free acoustic guitar music. Then you have bad microphones and questions like, in your latest book, you talk a lot about sports. Have sports always been important to your writing? When you're putting together your book, do you organize each chapter and think about the characters in advance? Boring. You want to talk about that? You go on some other podcast. This is not what this is about. I mean, we just spent, 20 minutes talking about West Virginia and why West Virginia is cool.
Yeah, my favorite podcast out there, hands down, is currently Mark Maron's What the Fuck.
Oh, yes. I'm familiar. I haven't really gotten into it yet, but I know of it.
I'm a drug addict for that show, and it's about an hour and 10-minute interview with basically all the comics of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's done somewhere around 500 of them now.
Yeah.
And they are absolutely compelling, and they rarely talk craft.
Mm.
And in any of the interviews, they rarely talk crap. It's mostly like you. The reason I accepted this interview, because I rarely do them, was because you said, "Oh no, we just want to talk about talking, you know, like hanging out."
Yeah.
Okay, I can do that.
I have a cup of coffee here. I just finished it.
There's a lot of much better writers and much better people, frankly, in the world to ask questions about that matter. If you want to just talk about, you know, West Virginia and hanging out, I'm in.
No, I totally understand. Now, there's a couple I follow. One is The Nerdist, Chris Hardwick, and his podcast. And then over winter break, I finally got into Welcome to Night Vale. And that has blown my head open, basically. I'm like, it's deserved the accolades. It started to pick up steam in the last 2 years. It overtook in 1 year. It overtook Ira Glass on the iTunes podcast charts.
Wow.
In 1 year, in less than a year, suddenly just out of nowhere, they went from like 75 to 1 in no time and bumped everyone off for comedy podcast in 1 week. And they're still pretty much going strong. And I dig it. That's when I'm not advertising. This isn't public or anything. It's in my humble opinion, as the kids would say on the internet, IMHO, I think it's an enjoyable one.
Cool. I'll check it out.
It's a bit purpley. The prose is a little bit purple at times, but that's part of the style of it. But no, Mark Maron, definitely, I find some of his episodes to be good. The clips I've seen, I know that he's kind of a divisive figure. Some people really cannot stand him, though, because of they're critical of his tactics or his personality or whatever. But
yeah, he's a stand-up comic, so, you know, anybody that's been a stand-up comic in this country for 30 or more years has usually got a very large mixed following.
Yeah, there's only a couple I can think.
Very opinionated, and he worked for Air America as the morning drive time guy for a long. I mean, the guy's he's done a lot of things that are divisive, and he's had a lot of kind of issues with that. He brings it to the podcast often. Whoever the guest will come in and say, he'll say, "Well, what did I do to you?" And the guest will say, "Well, you screwed me over this way." They'll work through that, and then they'll start the interview. it's an interesting show. Largely, though, because it's people talking about their lives as opposed to talking about their art, and that's what I thought was fascinating about your idea.
Well, I every time I watch interviews, and I'm a media junkie, I'm a cultural critic. You know, I consider that to be my specialty as an academic is cultural criticism, even though that's not my title. I wish it was, because if I was, any movie I buy, any concert tickets I buy, anything, it's all a tax deduction because it's a work expense.
I think you could still play that if you wanted to.
I wrote a travel review
on it and wrote the whole thing up.
That's true, you know. Yeah, I want to go to Lollapalooza this year. I don't even know if Lollapalooza is still in existence at this point. I know that there's a
Coachella.
I could go to Coachella. I could go to South by Southwest.
There you go.
And be like, yeah, I want to go see these groups and everything, and I'm doing research for teaching intro to literature.
And you will inevitably find at least one group at a bar somewhere that will do an interview with you. And then you write the whole thing off.
Well, that's my hope is I'm not going to make AWP this year. This will be after, of course, it'll be well over by the time this airs. But I will be going, I'm hoping, next year to Minneapolis. And we're hoping that by that point, the podcast has taken off a little bit and gained some ground, because I would love to just get a laptop and a mic and just do recordings in hotel rooms with random people.
Yeah.
Just be like, all right, you five people, come on in here. We're going to do an interview with you five random people. I don't know any of you. Let's do this.
That would be cool. And AWP would be a crazy place to do that.
Oh, I think it would be. Yeah. Well, we'll see how that goes. We got to see how this takes off first. But no, I think that it's one thing to talk about craft. And I was going to say is I've watched a lot of interviews with stars and celebrities talking about, so tell us about your latest film. And they give the prepackaged answer that they've workshopped. But when you get the deep conversations, even on Inside the Actor's Studio, they're interesting, but interesting to a fault. And yeah, it's good to know about these craft, but if you are yourself, if you're curious about it, that's good. But if you're not actively going into that business or that style of entertainment, how much of it is really going to be useful to you?
Yeah.
But I'm more interested in things like, you know, West Virginia. I did not know West Virginia's. I knew they had a big folk art scene, but I didn't know about that. So already I'm learning stuff. Now, I've got a question for you, Ken.
Sure.
Okay, you grew up in Long Beach and everything, and you say you're 50, so I'm pegging you now because my mind is – I'm a musically inclined person, at least pop music. That's my area of deep love. So I can only imagine you were part of one amazing scene growing up in music.
Yeah.
I can only imagine because I read somewhere that you described yourself as post-punk.
I was a drummer for many years.
Really? Now, that I did not know.
Yeah.
So wait, okay. Let me back up then. What exactly does it mean to be post-punk? Because it still exists.
Well, it doesn't, does it?
It kind of
does. You
know,
there are people that would argue. I think there are people that would leg wrestle over this for hours. I don't know that the punk that I originally was involved in still exists. There are interesting folks out there that do amazing music. I'm not sure if it's the same stuff that I was doing that we called punk when first started. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it does, because my first thought was the Dropkick Murphys, who I think it's an amazing cross between Celtic and I would call it second wave punk, perhaps, maybe even third wave. And it's amazing, but is it on the same style or power of the Ramones or the Dead Kennedys or Jello Biafra?
Well, yeah, I grew up when X was a band you could go see for $2 on a Friday night. The X and the Dead Kennedys and all of the bands, Black Flag and all the bands in that era. And then the fusion of all of it, because none of us had, there were no clubs that were specifically outlined in LA for any kind of music in particular. Mm. So you would have the same club would have rock and power funk and punk and sometimes on the same bill. It was just a time when LA was real confused about what was going on musically.
It's never had a cohesive art scene out there. It's always been, talking about the architecture, it's always been very eclectic, and that really goes to the art as well.
Well, it was just a real greedy time too in club ownership where people were, you would play a show, and to play a show you would have to pay the club, and then the club would give you tickets, and then you had to sell the tickets to people you knew to pay back the money to yourself that you had to pay for. I mean, no, really, it was like that in a lot of clubs in LA when I was playing and coming up through there.
Very sleazy. And so, you
know, it was a weird vibe, but it was also a bitchin' vibe, and you could meet an amazing amount of musicians and crazy people at virtually any place you went to most good nights of the week.
Now I'm so wondering,
it was a great scene. The late '70s, early '80s was insane musically in LA. It was amazing.
Yeah, I was a baby at that moment in upstate New York, and then the 80s come along and everything, and I start becoming conscious of it right around 84, 85. That's when my childhood brain finally starts collecting information and can remember in long-term storage, because I can still say that the first music video I ever saw was Bonnie Tyler's Total Eclipse of the Heart. I never forgot that. It was the first one I ever saw. And it broke my brain. And to this day, it breaks my brain now in a different way. I'm looking at it going, what the hell were you guys smoking on this one? This makes absolutely no sense. But now I go back, and here I am in my 30s now. And I'm actually really, I wish for time travel for one thing. I wish I could go back to my 15-year-old self and go, here is the double disc album, The Ramones, Their Toughest Hits. Listen to it. You need it now.
When I first moved to West Virginia, my best friend that I had made out here, great guy, Scott Dennis, we wrote a couple of films together. He had never heard of like Social Distortion, and because it never made it to West Virginia. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that kind of music never made it on anybody's radio.
Mm-hmm.
And it only made it largely when it first started in underground record companies, record stores, which also didn't really exist much out here.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the places it passed by. It just didn't quite make it into West Virginia much. Morgantown's always had a good music scene.
Mm.
And I mean, a really good one. By the standard of the size of the city, it is a surprisingly good music scene. They've got a great club in town that draws a lot of great acts. I just saw the Super Suckers there?
Oh, okay. A
couple of weeks back. Great club. It's called 123 Pleasant Street. But largely the state was basically ignored by that kind of music. And
right.
So,
well, I can understand. I mean, there's not much profit, so to speak, in that, because it's taken over. I'm thinking, it's a state that's dominated by country western music.
Country music does well here, but so does a lot of other music. This is, like I say, because they're very art supportive here.
Mm-hmm.
You get a lot of different kinds of music here, but bluegrass is real popular in parts of the state, especially mm-hmm. the southern parts of the state. We've got some really really good bands out here.
But punk just kind of passed over, and so
yeah. But the hardest part of the edgiest part of punk, the earliest part of punk, just kind of missed out. Kids nowadays have much more than we had.
Mm-hmm.
Without the internet and without, better access to social networking, you were kind of stuck hoping, if you were lucky enough to be one of those weirdo kids that
just
listening to Rihanna
across
for the 87,000th time didn't quite do it for you.
Yeah.
You had to search it out. Yeah. And if you didn't come from a city, it was really hard. I mean, a big city, it was really hard to search that stuff out.
So
now,
I'm curious.
Well, now music is so fused out. You hear music that comes out now, and it's three or four different genres fused into this one genre, and it's because people are being introduced to so much more now. That's a great thing. But at the time, back then, it wasn't so much that. A lot of learning about new music meant going out and finding it, not just to record stores, but to clubs. I mean, just going out
mm-hmm.
and finding bands that you fall in love with, and then they turn out to be the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Yeah. Later, somebody comes along and says they're cool, but you loved them because they were a trip way before anything else was. You know, does that make sense?
I think we still have that to a degree because we're always giving each other suggestions like, oh, you got to check this band out. And so you go to YouTube and you pull up a song or two of theirs. That's the new record store for us. So
yeah, yeah.
It's still there.
The fact that you have YouTube, because even, you know, unless you had an independent record store, major chains didn't carry much. I was in a band called The Conditions for a while, and they had released, I forget, was it 11 albums?
Mm-hmm.
They released 10 albums. The 11th one finally got carried by a major chain.
Mm.
Punk just largely got ignored by the chain stores. And so if you really heard it, you know, you couldn't find it unless you were lucky enough to have some bong selling / chain whip bondage selling / record store thing in your neighbor, in your town. If you did, then you'd be able to find a few records that were a little weird. Once you found them, you know, you could get a magazine like Maximum Rock and Roll, and that was kind of the YouTube of the day. It was a paper rag. It was very thick. It told you every place to play in the entire country, and you could see weird names, and you could kind of look them up, find out what town they were from, and write them a letter, and see if they had a disc they could, you know, a cassette they could sell you, or a record they could sell you, an EP or something. I mean, it was punk was word of mouth. I mean, all the way through it until. Mm-hmm. That's why I say it's not the same thing. If you've got a major label representation, then I don't know how you could be punk.
I think a lot of people said that punk in the 90s, punk came back briefly via the grunge movement but it wasn't the same punk by any means, but you know, you had Nirvana, and we're still not in social media world, but somebody like Nirvana and Kurt Cobain comes out and they say, you know, who are you listening to? And he's like, the Melvins, Primal Scream, Vaseline's. And then you want to go out and find these bands yourself. So you pick these albums up, and then the grunge movement dies off a little bit. And then we get Avril Lavigne.
Yeah, I know.
And but people were like, she's punk.
Some really interesting, I mean, Pavement. I mean, there were some bands that came out that came out long after, you know, punk hit its wind and hit its stride, and they were still, I love Pavement. There's some bands out that just knocked me out.
No, I agree.
And I think the whole alt country music movement, I don't even know what they call it anymore. Americana or roots rock, whatever the hell it is. Alt country is what we used to call it.
Yeah.
Had a lot of its influence in early punk stuff.
I've often said that actually the outlaw movement is punk in country because they come from the same place, which is punk is seen as a response to the excess of glam rock and disco. It's a return to three chords and the truth, 2-minute song. And in country, you had the Rhinestone Cowboy, because country music's always had this problem of it can't stand on its own, it feels like, so it has to go pop, and that's what we're seeing now. And then Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings come and go, no, let's bring it back to what it should be. And they become almost the punk of country then, at the same time.
Outlaws, they call them, yeah.
The outlaw movement. And that dies off, though, eventually, not completely, because Waylon Jennings is basically a hard asshole until he's dead. He's considered the biggest outlaw of country ever, because he's still an asshole right up until his death, in the good way too. Although I would be terrified to interview him. I would have been terrified. But so yeah, we have this new version of punk, and what I find interesting is the best punk right now is not in the United States. It's around the globe.
Yeah, and that's not uncommon. I think that's good punk's always been around the globe, except it wasn't necessarily classified. It was called punk there, but it wasn't. In 1984, when LA hosted the Olympics, an old boxing arena called the Olympic Auditorium put on a big punk festival concert.
Okay.
They called it the Olympics of Punk, and it was punk bands from all over the world.
Mm.
And there were bands. I think Dead Kennedy was the headliner on one of the nights that I was there, and there was a lot of good stuff going on that night. But there was also a lot of like hair bands from Spain, and I mean, they weren't anything that we would call punk. It's just that I guess in their community, in their world, that was punk to them. But punk has always, there's been a lot of a lot of the world that's always been open to the idea of it, for sure.
There's something in it. Japan has a very big punk hardcore scene.
Yeah, and Germany always had a real big scene, too. Still probably does.
Oh, it still does. I mean, I've said before, there is no band like Rammstein to see.
Yes.
It's nothing like them. Any band where the lead singer will light himself on fire for half the show, it deserves my respect. Along with Kraftwerk is still out there, still pumping out stuff. But they're kind of Daft Punkish in that they'll hide for a long time and then come out when the time is right.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff going on, I think, in some of the former Soviet states too.
I was about to say, there's a
friend of mine's about to go on a tour out there. Jay Marinelli's about to go on a tour with his band to that part of the world. I sent him a note and said, look, if you write about this trip while you're gone, I'll publish the damn thing. I'd love to read it.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, I'd love to know what the music scene is like in that part of the world right
there,
now.
There's some amazing stuff. I can give you one band right now that you can look up after this podcast, a band called Ruskaja. They are a Slovakian gypsy folk punk band. And you mix those genres into this most insanely wonderful sound with gypsy fiddle versus electric guitar versus screaming throat hardcore, almost death metal sound.
With a lot of repetitive rhythm in it too. That could be
exactly
interesting.
And no, it's an amazing scene what's happening in Eastern Europe right now, also in punk. So I don't think it's dead. I just think that here in America, we watered it down maybe.
It's just different. That's all. It's just different. And I think people can call it whatever they want. It really matters to not in any way to me or probably anybody. People call whatever they want, whatever they want.
You know, punk.
It's just not the same. That's all. It's just not the same kind of music.
Yeah. And that's fair. I think one of the problems with the internet really is we've become much more elitist about our fandoms in that we are quick to dismiss other things and go, well, that's not blank.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. Early punk to me seemed like folk music that was really pissed off. it had basic rhythms. It had basic, almost rockabilly root stuff. Look at the work that the X was doing, and look at the work that Dave Alvin has done when he was with X, and then later when he was with the Blasters, and then later on his own. And you know, Alvin he studied from Gerald Lachlan. He's got a book or two out. He got an MFA from Long Beach. But so he's one of us. He's a writer too, in addition to being a songwriter. That stuff, that music back, listen to the Ramones, the bands that we were listing. These were bands that had largely, kind of 1950s rock music.
Three chords and the truth, 2 minute length songs.
Real, but with attitude, you know, and maybe it was no longer, you know, peace and love will save us. Maybe it was, let's burn this fucker to the ground and see what comes out of the ashes will save us. So it's still, you know, it's just another variation on the theme. It just was a really kind of angry theme.
Yeah, I mean, I just one pops into my head right now. I'm thinking Simon Garfunkel, Paul Simon, very definitive New York type songwriter. And then you put that up against 53rd and 3rd by the Ramones. And they're telling the same story. The boxer Simon Garfunkel versus 53rd and 3rd, same song, just one is much more blunt and shorter about it.
Yeah, I always think a lot of it had to do with earlier music was a little more optimistic, I think. Punk was just sort of, okay, then fuck it. If it's going to shit, let's make it go faster.
Okay.
Whereas the earlier, like the Simon and Garfunkel analogy you're making, they wrote a lot more stuff that seemed like life could turn out okay.
In the end, yeah.
But it just wasn't turning out okay for anyone that we knew. And anybody that I knew was. So why?
So punk is more...
It reflects the world you live in. Why would you...
Yeah. Punk is more cynical and nihilistic then.
I mean, I don't even know that. It was tired of listening to the bullshit.
Fair enough.
I'm not saying that music and that time and all that was bullshit. I love all that music and I still listen to all the stuff that came before. But it seemed like at that point in history, it was stupid. It just seemed so stupid to keep playing that game. Mm. And then, you know, there was a lot of other things going on at that point. You know, you got to think early 80s, there was enough cocaine in America to choke. God, you know, Wisconsin, and it was, you know, all of that affected the music. You can't say that having vast amounts of Quaaludes and cocaine and everything else that was flying around wasn't affecting the music. So
definitely not.
Music is always delineated. You know, it's always this period and this period and this period, and then there's the ones that blend through the periods. But you know, I think the newer music, it's not the same music that I played, but I don't think that it's bad. I still think there's a lot of great music.
No, I agree. It's really interesting, man. There, you know, even to this day, cheap pop tunes. Nick Hornby writes about this in his book Songbook, where he's like, I know that, you know, I forget what his comparison is. He's like, I know that Marvin Gaye is better than what I'm listening, you know, what's on the radio right now. I know these things. It's just that there's this song I heard on the radio and I went out and bought the single and now I've heard it 70 times and I can't help it.
Yeah.
And I feel that there's a couple songs from last year. Icona Pop's, their song, their big one of the summer, gets infectious. Daft Punk's Get Lucky is damn catchy. Partly because Nile Rodgers is the producer and guitar player on it, and I'm like, well, I know his work. So I think it's still there, and it's still good. It's just different. I think you're right. It's just, it's not what we had. It's what they have, but I'm not going to dump on it.
No, not at all. There's a lot of, why dump on it? It just is stupid.
It doesn't solve anything.
For all of his pluses and minuses, you know, has always said that why is it that we lock ourselves into generational music? This is the music of our generation. And why would you do that to yourself? You know, then you lose on so much else. It's a little hard for me to hear life advice or love advice from a 17-year-old. Okay, but there is really good music that's being made by a lot of great bands that you don't hear about every day anymore.
No, and I think underground is where it's at right now. Really,
I think some mainstream bands are underground. You know, I mean, one of the bands I used to really love was Cracker.
Okay.
With David Lowery and John Hickman. And
yeah.
Brilliant group. And they're still out touring. They still do a crap load of shows every year. Plus, you know, half the bands releasing their own solo stuff every year as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of bands that were hard to get tickets to. You can find in a lot of small clubs these days.
Oh, yeah.
I think a lot of people are foolish not to take advantage of that opportunity.
I think one of the best,
insanely talented.
One of the best shows I ever went to, I got for really cheap, and this was our lineup, was Quiet Riot before Kevin Dubrow died, Slaughter, Night Ranger, and then the headliner was Ted Nugent. It was 4 hours, and I was actually like five rows in front of the speakers, so it was like 5 hours of that. And then I got to do a late night, like 1 a.m. interview with a local metal band on radio. So it was like 8 hours, and my ears are bleeding, and I felt great.
It's a good day.
It was a good day. My students are kind of shocked when I tell them that, yeah, Dr. Finbo used to play in the mosh pits, and I'm not talking like arena pits. I'm talking $2. 17 band shows with wallet chains and work boot pits. And they look at me weird, especially because when I tell that story, I start rubbing my left hand because I'm looking for that black Sharpie X to be back there.
Like, oh, you know, I heard that, speaking of some of the older music, I heard that Oingo Boingo was going to go out on tour.
I did not hear that yet.
And I heard that Elfin was deaf. So that's got to be an interesting tour.
I did not know that he was, I mean, he's still doing movie scores, though, and everything, so, Oingo Boingo, man, there's a band for you. Have you ever seen the movie The Forbidden Planet?
Yeah, years ago, right?
The Forbidden Zone, with them, yeah, it's Elfman's first film. It is a total head trip, but, you know, out of that comes the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo, and then he goes on to do, I think his first one is Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
And then the Simpsons theme.
Yep. Which is a combination of actually Frank Zappa and a few others.
The early Batman remakes with Burton, I think, were Keaton.
The Keaton ones, the Tim Burton ones.
Yeah, I think he did those.
He did Nightmare Before Christmas.
Left his imprint. There's no question.
Oh, definitely.
That.
He and Alf Floss and others have just.
And I can't. I mean, I saw a lot of bands when I was younger, and there's very few that I liked seeing more live than Oingo Boingo. They were a great live band.
I bet they were. I can't speak to it again. I didn't start going to concerts until the mid 90s. And even then, it was a limited function, you know, limited kind of thing. And you know, my first one was the Marshall Tucker Band. And, you know, I saw a few.
Love Marshall Tucker. I still listen to a lot of Marshall Tucker.
I got, you know, sometimes I will catch myself just going around going, can't you see what that woman done to me? And I still go around singing it in my head sometimes. So I got nothing against that. I saw Dylan with Natalie Merchant just right around the time of Time Out of Mind, his revival album. And I remember it was a strange concert because Dylan smiled at the audience and went, thanks, everybody. And as someone who had knew Bob Dylan's music for a few years at that point, that was shocking. And I was convinced it was because he had the heart attack, and that's why he was thanking everybody and smiling for the first time.
I don't know, man. I've seen him a lot of times. Probably my favorite time that I saw Dylan was in Altoona, Pennsylvania. He was doing something he was calling the Field of Dreams Tour, and he was playing minor league ballparks all over.
Okay.
And Willie Nelson was the opening act, and Willie had been off for a while for wrist surgery, I think. Mm. And so this was like his first comeback thing, and it was at this ball club, and it was empty. I mean, you could walk right up to the stage at any point during the concert and stand 3 feet from Dylan. Charlie Sexton was his band leader for that tour. I mean, it was otherworldly brilliant. Yeah, when I saw Dylan during the Field of Dreams tour, this must have been 2000, I'm going to say 4.
Okay.
And there was nothing about that show that wasn't vital. There was nothing about that show that was in any way felt like bringing out old. I mean, Willie, it was one of the few times I ever heard him do an entire set that sounded like the records.
Mm.
They were record perfect. It was like listening to your album, except he was standing there. And, you know, I've seen it many, many times. And often he'll do two sets on a show, and the first set will be kind of the old standards, and the second set will be basically jazz versions of those songs. Nothing of that. It was straight, hard-hammering Willie, and then right into Dylan with, like I said, Charlie Sexton was his band leader, so all the songs were driving and just hard stomping.
Brutal.
And I'm telling you, It was master craft class. There was nothing about it that looked like, you know, bringing out the moment. It was a moment.
Bringing it back full circle almost, we come back to the podcast, and if you want to know your craft, there's a great example of knowing the craft.
Yeah, no kidding.
Oh.
Yeah, no kidding.
I can only imagine some of the shows that you've seen that we haven't even talked about, you know, growing up in that scene and such. I can only imagine what it was like. And being a part of it, being part of that scene as well, man. There's so much we could chat about here, and you know, we haven't even touched on your involvement with the medical marijuana movement in West Virginia, which I find really amazing.
Oh yeah, we can talk about that if you want. I don't mind.
Nah, I don't. You know, we're at the hour mark. I mean, I don't know what you got to do if you got to go anywhere or anything like that. You know, Connotation Press, you know, you've told me that you were a writer first, but then you went over to publishing.
I'm probably still in a writer. It's just that
all your writing goes to the press.
Well, the more the magazine got bigger and bigger, the less time I had for anything that was even closely resembling. I do a little bit of stuff in film, and I do a lot of different things, but it's become very, very, very difficult to do much writing. I've become more of a publisher, but
it's the way things are. I know once I started becoming a teacher full time, all of my writing goes to student comments and such on papers. Yeah. So, you know, I don't have any, you know, I come home maybe at 9, 10 o'clock. I got nothing in the tank to, you know, I don't want to sit down and write poems for myself.
Yeah. I do a Facebook post of a new artist from the magazine just about every day of the week for just about the last 5 years. And that's been, if you can imagine what that's like, trying to think of something to say
something,
365 something days a year for 5 years about different writers. It can get kind of exhausting.
I bet.
But you know, there's nothing about doing the magazine I don't love. It's just exhausting. And, and I have a private life, and the people that I have in my life are disturbingly valuable to me. And so the minutes that I have, the older I get, the less I just have patience for doing much other than hanging out with them.
No, I know.
That's kind of, you mentioned the medical marijuana thing. That's kind of you know, part of the situation. When I got back from West Virginia, when I got back to West Virginia, I had been living in California. I have frontal lobe epilepsy.
Okay.
Which is why I don't play music anymore. It's what took me out. So when we came back to West Virginia, my girlfriend, who is the poetry editor of the magazine,
and now fiance.
Yeah, now fiance Kate Hillenbrath, she couldn't just understand how I went from having a medication for these seizures that worked extremely well for me to being basically a criminal overnight because we moved.
Mm.
And so Kate said, you know, I should go to law school and do something about it. I laughed. Yeah, go for it. So she did. And
she's a lawyer. Yes.
And wrote a full legalization bill for West Virginia, which sparked the medical bill getting kind of pushed through. We have a lot of precedent now. There's, you know, 20 states with medical laws plus the state. There's two fully legal states. So you don't get harassed as much. But one of our representatives in West Virginia, Mike Mannypenny, in Taylor County, brilliant man, got together with Matt Simon from the Marijuana Policy Project.
Mm-hmm.
And they wrote a medical bill, which is currently, you know, on the floor of the House right now. I went down and I spoke at the state capitol at the House of Representatives, and they made a little Chuck Yeager's grandson owns the pilot.
Yeah.
Or granduncle or grandnephew or something, anyways, owns a production company down in Charleston in the state capitol, and they did a little documentary about me and so it's been a kind of a weird scene because, you know, it doesn't make anybody want to sell you pot if you're on the news.
No. So it's like, hey, you know, can I get Dimebag? No, we know you.
Yeah.
When I was in grad school and I was poor, a friend of mine and I were like, how can we get money? And we decided we'd go into the drug business. And then we figured it out. How do you get started? Do you just walk down the street and go, excuse me, do you have 100 kilos of cocaine you're not going to be using? Because we want to get into the business and we don't have any capital.
Yeah, it's kind of a tough sell, that.
It is. So we decided eventually we would just sell our plasma and our hair, but we couldn't find any of those places. So we just gave up and took out more student loans, you know.
Well, I just finally came to the conclusion that, you know, the way that things get changed is that people stand up and make those changes. And a change like this is going to require people to see that medical marijuana has a value other than just goofy kids getting stoned.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, at my age, you have to take hits for the younger people because they're not going to be listened to in the same way.
Right.
So, you know, they're always looking for when they're putting together a panel of people to talk, they're always looking for a cross section of people. And as someone that teaches college and as someone that's a publisher and done some things that were relatively okay, I get asked a lot to do that kind of stuff. And I never say no. I never turn it down because there's people out there that are, there's politicians out there that are putting their reputations on the line trying to help me out.
Right. And this is your passion. You know, this is something that, you know, as a medicine works for you.
Yeah.
And provides you with what you need.
It's wildly successful on seizures if you use the right.
I have to say, as someone who actually, believe it or not, has never done it or anything, you know, like it, to me, I find some of the research fascinating on it. And I think, you know, I'm one of those people that's like, look, logically speaking, there might be something here based on the anecdotal evidence and some scientific research here. It might be worth it. And I was just reading recently, recently as in recording, about possibly loosening the government funding on it and saying, okay, fine, let's start maybe looking in pushing some money toward investigating this stuff.
Yeah, the U.S. Attorney General last 2 weeks ago, I think, came out and said banks should begin to make arrangements to do business with the fully legal companies in Washington and Colorado. And it's all stepping in the right direction.
It is. You know, I'm curious to see what's going to be like in, say, 5 years, what the status is going to be.
It'll be legal nationwide in 5 years, for sure.
You think so?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I don't think it'll be 3 years before we see some legalization stuff get through the House and the Senate. It'll depend on who the president is at the time, but yeah, I think it'll be a lot sooner than 5 years.
I think as composition professors, we're going to be happy on one front, and that is that's one less major topic that students want to write about in argument essays.
Yeah, you won't have to tell your students, and you can't write about pot.
You can't write about pot, euthanasia, or gun control, or abortion.
Yeah.
I tell my students that they're like, why can't we write about those? I'm like, because they're very complicated topics that you don't understand.
And well, I always tell the kids, because you can't outline topic like abortion in 8 pages.
Or even, a 3-page paper. You're going to be able to argue the whole case in 3 pages? No.
You can't set it up. It's not even a topic issue for me. To me, it's always an issue of, look, can you do justice to this topic in 6 pages or 8 pages?
Yeah, no, that's also a good way of looking at it. I mean, I actually asked my students this semester. I said, okay, let's talk about essay topics or anything. And I said, how many of you, would like to write on marijuana if you could? And a couple raise their hands or whatever, maybe. And I said, how many of you actually know what the law says in Colorado about the sale and legalization? And they're like, and I'm like, you do know that although Colorado legalized it, it's still a federal offense. So why isn't the government coming in with the riot cops and breaking it all down? And I'm like, yeah, you wouldn't be able to write a 3-page argument about this, would you?
Not at all. And then that's what it's always about to me.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it was always harder getting the abortion stuff, or especially, teaching at times in the Bible Belt. You get a lot of proselytizing in the essays, and good for them, but it's just not what we do. So
right.
That's the harder part, is trying to convince them that it's not about you being talented or not talented. It's, there's not enough space allotted for you to even make the argument, let alone prove the argument, let alone substantiate it.
Exactly.
Convince me of anything,
An argument essay is like a review, in the sense that reviews start with emotion, and that's fine, but we have to go beyond the emotion to logic and reason as well.
I hope so.
I hope so too. We're well past an hour here. I feel like, I feel like we've got so much more that we could talk about. Real quick though, before we go, so where can people find you on the internet right now?
In what way?
Well, I mean, first off, let's give the web address for Connotation and everything, so they know where to find you.
We're at connotationpress.com.
CONNOTATIONPRESS.com. My spelling is terrible.
That's okay. Me too. That's why. the gods created spell check. So
indeed,
it means we can still be writers.
Yeah, that's true. And do you have Twitter or anything like that for the press?
Yeah, we probably do. I've got a.
I'll check with my other guys on that one.
That works with me. That's supposed to keep up on that. I don't follow too much of it. That part of the company.
But at the very least, people can find you at connotationpress.com.
Yeah, and we have our Facebook page, where we publish a new artist every single month from the magazine. We link up, and we do a lot of promotion for the writers. We just released our first single author print collection this month.
Awesome!
It actually technically releases on the 28th, but presale goes out tomorrow, and it's by Len Koontz. It's called The Dark Sunshine. It's a collection of short fiction, and it's stunning. Len's published over 700 pieces. This is his first print collection, and it's our first print single author print collection. So it's exciting and fun. I know that you're working with Erin, and she's been doing this for years and years, and really talk about one of the first to understand the value of the internet.
Sazeros was 1999.
Yeah, no, Erin is
that's 15 years.
Erin is she's a fucking genius.
I agree, in many ways.
And she could see well ahead of where everybody else was.
Oh.
When we built Connotation Press, I built it because the guy that helped me build it and I put it together because we thought the internet had finally caught up to what we wanted to do.
Mm.
Erin didn't bother to wait. She just started doing what she wanted to do and make it work. And
hey, but even then, we might be talking in 10 years of Connotation hitting its 15th anniversary in August 2024.
I just think it's lovely. I love that the magazine's online. I fought very hard to build something that had that should be respected as opposed to dismissed just because it's online. And I think that's kind of come and went. I think the days of ignoring something just because it's online are over with.
I think that, I feel those days are numbered.
Yeah, but I also think that having something in print is invaluable.
Oh, it is.
So the magazine is something that will live long, much longer than I will. You know, I'm setting up trust support for the magazine so that long after I'm gone, even if we're not publishing, it'll still be online.
It'll still be there.
Yeah, absolutely. Whereas the print stuff, you know, it doesn't matter if online exists or not.
It'll still be there.
It'll still be there. And either way, I feel like myself, my team, I feel like we're leaving the world a little better than we found it. I think that's the point, isn't it? There's a lot of reasons to publish art. My reason is because it makes the world better than it was without it.
I think that's probably it.
That's, there's no other ulterior motive. I don't publish art to make friends in the arts. I don't publish art to get myself published. I don't publish art because I think that I'm the guy that knows how to do it. I publish art because any publishing of the arts makes the world better. And I publish art with a lot of care and a lot of respect because I was trained that way by people like Frank Gaspar, who I first started studying with, and Moria Simon, who I first started studying with, Chris Buckley. They taught me to love it, not just be part of it, not just in some way tied to it, but to absorb it, to own it in an emotional way, in a pure way. And so we do this magazine. You know, I've done almost 5 years of Connotation Press. We have never charged for anything other than the print stuff we've done. It all comes out of my pocket. There's been times when I'm making $800 a month as a teacher, and I'm still publishing the magazine.
Still putting it out there.
And it's all coming out of my pocket every month. It's not free to have a website.
You know, no, it is not.
A website is not a web, WordPress kind of. It's an actual website.
Yeah.
And it's not cheap.
No, it is not. Server space is not cheap.
No, it's not. And now we're moving. In 2 months, we're moving to our own dedicated server. So,
whew.
Yeah, the price just exponentially keeps rising.
Yes. Best of luck to it, though. I'm looking forward to seeing what you guys are going to come out with in the next few months.
I'm looking forward to seeing what you do in the next few months because this is a neat idea.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens. But of course, Ken, you are welcome to come back in the future.
Thanks. Who else have you interviewed so far?
We've got a bunch on the docket, and we're loading up on others as well. I would tell you who, but I don't know what order this is going to run in or anything like that. So people will be like, wait, you already talked about them. But no, things like that. So I'm trying
Just keep me informed on what's going on with it. And I'll help promote it a little bit.
I'm trying to avoid the fanboys that might go, but Scott, you said that this person was going to be on the podcast and they weren't. And I'm going to be like, oh, shut up.
Well, you can think that way, Scott, or you can think, the other way. Well, next week we're going to have Natasha Trethewey.
Yeah.
And in 2 weeks after that, Robert Bly is going to stop in the studio.
I've got plans.
And then when they don't show up, you can tell them all to fuck off.
It's like, hey. And I think that once it lands on the air and we start building it, people are skeptical. The people I've asked are a little skeptical. They're like, wait, what exactly is this about? You're not the only one who's contacted me. I'm like, but I'm not a writer. Why would you want me? And I have to explain, no. It's because you're a cool person and I want to talk to you about cool things.
That's cool. Yeah. And you come from the good group. So, you're in a really solid group.
They're good people, but you also come out of a good group as well, Ken. And I really do thank you for coming on here. And, I know you don't give much in the way of interviews, but thank you so much. This has been a blast.
No, I appreciate it, Scott. And thank you very much for thinking of me. And tell everybody at SAFTA I said hi. I love those guys. I have published so many of you guys.
I know.
Every single one of them that I've met over in that.
Maybe if I get back to writing, I'll throw some work your way, but we'll see.
No, I think if everything goes like it's supposed to, that's going to end up being a really important center for a lot of great.
I think we'll too. And I'm, you know, you are welcome to, and we hope that you'll work with us as well with Connotation and everything. And we look forward to long, healthy friendship and partnership with you guys. Ken, this has been a blast. Seriously, man, it's been great. And I thank you so much for being here.
All right, Scott. Thank you, pal.
You take care of yourself now.
All right. Bye.
Bye.